as we get the hour underway by welcoming back to the show and back to the studio our friend Michael Sokolow. He is a professor at the University of Maine, a Fulbright scholar. His writing is seen in great publications all around the country. Mike, thanks for coming back.
Good to see you, Rich.
How's your summer been going?
Oh, it's been going very well.
Watching a lot of sports?
I'm watching a lot of sports. My kid's playing American Legion baseball.
And, nice.
as well as the professional sports. And the Olympics coming up.
That's right. Absolutely. A whole lot going on. I think we'll talk about the Olympics as well. But want to talk about the media and their coverage of the presidential election this year. And I'm curious what your thought is on what you've seen so far in this cycle.
Well, what I've seen is that... and it's kind of fascinating, is that nobody really knows how to handle it. It strikes me that everybody's trying to orient themselves by looking at history. And so you get a lot of people and a lot of people saying, you know, oh, you can't replace Biden because it's never been done before, right? Or they lost when they've replaced the nominee or this or that. And I'm not sure there really is a historical precedent that we can orient ourselves around in this way. So that's been the most interesting and curious part for me. Like, what if we really are in uncharted area?
Well, I think we certainly are. And we were talking about it yesterday, that the timeline has increased exponentially here when you look at just the developments over the last few weeks.
Yeah, and what I really enjoy about your show is you have Joanne Freeman, you have, you know, from Yale, you have so many historians on. You have, you know, people who can do this kind of orientation. And you're a historian. You know, you know the background as well as anybody. But my kind of take on the punditry, though, is that for all that we're trying to do this, why can't we, this is where I'm curious, right? Why can't we actually talk amongst ourselves with the idea that this has never happened before? And what does that then mean? And there's even something stranger I was thinking about today. 2016, we have an election where the nominee of one of the major parties is a Hollywood celebrity, is a TV star who's never been elected to anything before. So that was a crazy election, okay? I mean, it totally nothing
right,
like it.
Because I believe until that point, we had never had a president who had not either held office or served in the military.
Right. So it would seem that he would lose for other reasons and this and that, because it was totally revolutionary in that way. Then in 2020, you got COVID. You got a presidential campaign where nobody campaigns. Nobody had ever seen that before. Actually, I take that back. Trump did technically campaign. He came out here to Tejon Orchards. He came out
to Lodomar. Took off the mask and killed one of his biggest supporters with one of his rallies out there.
That's right. The pizza
Herman
guy.
Cain.
Herman
yeah.
Cain. But it wasn't a normal campaign by any stretch of the imagination. And now we're in 2024, and one of the parties has replaced its nominee in July, a month before the convention. So this is our third presidential election in a row, a third one in 8 years, where nobody's really seen anything like it. And so I'm sitting here thinking, let's sit with the ambiguity, the novelty, the new things. Let's not decide whether history is going to dictate it or not.
Yeah, and I guess my complaint with the coverage that I've seen, and I watch a lot. I watch MSNBC. I'll watch Fox. I can't bring myself to watch Newsmax, but I'll watch the mainstream networks and see what's going on out there. And with all of them, there is that fallback position that they all seem to take of covering the horse race aspects of it. For weeks there, every single news story seemed to start with the latest poll. And as we know, polls are merely a snapshot of that moment in time. And as we've witnessed in recent elections, may not have a great deal of relevance as to what's going to happen come November. And especially on the shows that specialize in punditry, speculation is the coin of the realm as opposed to any level of analysis.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really surprised me, actually. The role the polls played, obviously the most important reason for the switch from Biden to Harris was the debate. And his physical his physical capabilities at this point. But the polls were second, and they were pretty close. I mean, in terms of the reason why, they were a huge motivating factor. And there's a wonderful book by Joe Campbell, the historian, called Lost in a Gallup. And once you read it, you will not look at polls the same way again, because it is surprising how divorced from reality polls can be. And even when they're correct for a single snapshot in time. Yeah. They're correct for July 22nd. And so so that I agree with you. That did surprise me a lot.
And I'm not sure what's the chicken and what's the egg in these situations, because immediately after that debate, major news services, publications like the New York Times, began running day after day stories about Joe Biden's health condition. What influence did that have on the polls? Because we know, yes, the debate was well watched, I think, what, 50 million or so, but there are a whole lot of people that didn't see it that may well have seen on social media a headline from the New York Times: is Biden too old? Have they been keeping his health a secret? What's going on? Where is Joe Biden?
Well, no, that I'm almost laughing because if you remember the first polls in within 48 hours of the debate, they were the same.
Yeah,
he actually gained. Biden gain one
poll
point or
he
two?
Gained a point. Yeah, yeah.
Which tells you exactly what you need to know there, whether the polls should be used or not. But that's why I do think that the motivating factor is just his physical capabilities being hidden, and how well the journalist did or did not do in appreciating that. It's too early. We don't know. So an interesting debate I have with a friend of mine who's a scholar who really knows these things thinks that he thinks we're going to be in for a flood of tell-all books after January about just how bad things are right now in Biden, that they were successful in hiding. I don't know. You know, I just don't know enough.
No, and it's hard to tell. Again, he's been pretty protected. We know that. But then when you do see him out there interacting, yes, obviously a lot of it is reading the teleprompter, but hey, Trump's got a teleprompter, and even with that, he still dumps his buffer on a regular basis. So I don't know. I don't think any of us know for sure what the situation is, but it scared people. And I think it scared people, especially when you looked at the other candidate. And I wonder now, with Kamala Harris seemingly going to be the Democratic candidate here, does the media shift, and do we finally, I would say, see stories about Trump's mental acuity and what seems to be clearly slipping even from what was shaky 4 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we'll see it. You know, my concern is a little bit further down the road, right? Because we're in July and nobody's really paying attention. Mm. And if you look at the numbers for the media and everything, it's really after Labor Day. It's going to be what happens in late September through October. And I have a strange concern that that there will be people jumping ship from the Biden-Harris with tell-alls. This is related. I have no idea if this is true, but if you remember closely, this happened to Trump in 2020, right? There were insiders who were very angry with him about the vaccine mandates that he included mm-hmm. for the federal government. There was the guy who published the resistance op-ed about the border who worked for him. A lot of people came out of the woodwork in 2020. And went after Trump when he didn't look like a winner. And it had a thing. And I'm kind of concerned about the position that the Biden-Harris campaign is in that way. So, I mean, just here's my free press advice. Whatever they have, get out now. Get out in July. Right. Nobody will care. You know, if they got...
Right, and don't save it for your book that's coming out next year.
Exactly. Put it all out now from the inside. Be transparent, be honest, be candid. Do it all before Labor Day. So that, you know, Harris, in every kind of debate, in every kind of press conference, everything, can say, we answered that. We, you know, we said that. Mm-hmm. Because if it becomes a kind of thing that dribbles out like Watergate, you know, over 6 months or 3 months, it could be really problematic.
And you wonder, I think somebody said this on social media today, what in the world could the October surprise be in this already strange election year?
Yeah, why don't they call it the July surprise?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking about that. It's the most surprising thing to certainly happen in the last four election cycles, maybe five. I mean, everybody made such a big deal out of the FBI reopening the Clinton case 7 days before the election as the great October surprise. This is much bigger than that.
Oh, yeah.
Much bigger.
By far. We're talking with Michael Socolow here on Downtown. I wanted to talk a little bit about coverage of the convention. We've only seen the RNC so far, and I was, again, mystified by that. I watched a lot, not all of it, and yet I feel like they get talking points, and they all say, we're going to talk about the unity that we see here. And so there was a lot of that, and people on all the networks, regardless of their perspective, talking about unity, and again, very little fact-checking, with the exception of Daniel Dale, who does that regularly for CNN.
But Rich, you're taking this seriously as a political political event.
And not as entertainment, yes.
Well, I didn't understand. I'll be honest with you. Hulk Hogan, what was her name? Amber Rose, Kid Rock. I'm not in the demographic that they were. Actually, I am. I'm an old white male, right?
right.
But I didn't understand. I didn't understand the programming. I didn't understand. I mean, I was kind of flabbergasted. No Pence, no Bush, no Cheney, no. The sheer number of heavyweight Republicans who did not show across America was fascinating to me. But that also shows, like Hulk Hogan and Kid Rock, that it really didn't matter. So
right.
I would say I was just befuddled by the whole thing.
Do you think the Democratic convention will be more traditional?
Oh, absolutely, because everybody's going to show up.
Yeah.
And so right off the bat, I think Democrats are going to have a very different problem. Trump and his administration, or his planners, had to figure out how to fill the airtime. The Democrats have the opposite problem. I think everybody's going to want a piece of this airtime so that they can get in with the Harris administration.
Right, right.
I mean, imagine, think of all these names that have been talked about for Veep. The people who aren't going to get it are going to insist on a primo spot, because it's well known that 2 days before the speaker who's nominated is the person who's coming up in the next cycle, right? Remember Obama in 2004, right. Clinton in 88. It's just well known. And so the fighting for that slot is going to be fascinating.
Debates. I did hear apparently late today, Trump says he will debate Kamala Harris. That will be interesting to see. But I wonder if these presidential debates have outlived their usefulness a little bit. I mean, first of all, they haven't been around that long. And I think I'm right on this. They went away for a while, too, that we didn't have debates for the better part of two decades.
That's right. 1960. And then we didn't have them until 76. But I actually think that the June debate that wasn't seen by 50. Did you say 15 or 50 million?
I thought it was 50.
Wasn't that many?
I might be wrong.
I thought it was less than that, but that I could believe that. But the it was the most consequential debate in history by far.
Oh yes,
it may have been one of the most consequential political television shows in history, because it forced one of the nominees out. Mm. And so when you say they outlived their usefulness, I say, oh, well, wait a minute. This, I think, the opposite. I think we would lose them because everybody, and this is well known, going back to the original debates between Nixon and Kennedy. Everybody was afraid to lose. Nobody cared about winning. I mean, they weren't called debates when they were started. They were called the joint press appearances. They weren't allowed to talk to each other. They weren't allowed to question each other. The whole thing isn't a debate. It's a joint press conference, frankly. And it was all set up entirely to insulate the two candidates from losing. And we finally have a truly clear-cut loser. You know, you could say Quayle to Benson. Quayle absolutely lost to Benson. Probably,
but Quayle still ended up as vice president.
Right, right. But I'm trying to think of colossal losses.
And you, Dukakis, Bush, the first Obama debate with
Dukakis, Bush was because of the Kitty Dukakis rape question by CNN guy, by Bernard Shaw.
Right.
So that's an interesting one. I think the way Biden lost was so colossal that more than anything is going to scare away the future.
And that was, I mean, that's a moment in television history, I think. I sat there, as I'm sure you did and others, stunned by what we were seeing.
And it got circulated in memes. I mean, the whole beating Medicare to the ground. I don't think he knows. I mean, I listened to both right-wing radio, left-wing radio. I listened to you. I listened to NPR. I listened to all of the stuff. And the number of soundboard cuts that right-wing radio is playing of "I don't think he knows what he said" by Trump is fascinating to me. It's constant.
It is a fascinating time indeed. Well, let's shift gears completely here and talk about the Olympics and the coverage of that starts up soon. It is an event that continues to grow financially. The commitment that networks have to put out to be a part of this now is staggering.
Well, no, remember they signed the contract in 2018 to go through 2032, so it's actually a bargain. NBC already knows it's going to make a profit. Okay. But what's fascinating to me is nobody's talking about it. Mm. We can't talk about the athletic stars. There's no Michael Johnson. There's no Carl Lewis. There's no, like I grew up with, you know, there's no, remember that gymnast, Caroli's the perfect 10. What's her name?
Nadia Comaneci.
Yeah. And none of that is permeating. But what's fascinating to me as a media historian is NBC and Peacock can still make a fortune, and yet it cannot have the public kind of impact that we all used to think about with the Olympics. And that's kind of a strange thing. It reminds me of boxing. You know, boxing has never made more money than it makes right now, but nobody knows who the heavyweight champion of the world is.
Right, right. Is that because the powers that be, like ESPN, they have a very limited number of subjects that they like to talk about? And they know, I talked years ago with a guy who was in charge of ESPN Sports Radio, and he said, we measure out every 2 minutes to see where the listeners are and what keeps them there and what drives them away. And it's NFL, NBA, NFL, NBA, and maybe we can mention Caitlin Clark once in a while if there's a controversy going, but they don't talk Major League Baseball. They rarely talk hockey. Certainly don't talk Olympics.
Yeah, and it's jarring to somebody when you're actually listening to the sports. If you tune into sports radio on the weekends occasionally, like I do, they will go through, they won't even do an entire segment on the baseball, on a baseball or coming up to the baseball trade. They will cut into a college football question in June.
Oh yeah,
And you can tell it's exactly that. It's the metrics telling them to do it,
and it's sad in a way because I, like you, I grew up watching the Olympics. I remember I'm old enough. I remember watching Bob Beamon set the record in Mexico City in '68.
I mean, and if you think about Mexico City '68, that was the first live global color satellite event in history. So it was surprising. It was amazing. You had Foreman. You had. I mean. Every single day you tuned in for something amazing. And in Munich, you had Mark Spitz, and then you had a terrorist attack. And then in 76, you had Montreal and Bruce Jenner. I mean, no, every 4 years, this was massive. And by the way, it was a huge moneymaker. People forget it was bigger than the NFL. It was bigger than anything. It was the single biggest. And that's why, by the way, NBC purchased it up to 2032, because it's well known. It is still, I believe, the most profitable. It's not the most rich, lucrative, but it's the most profitable sport property in the world.
And I wonder too if the advent of streaming and the changing landscape of how we watch athletic events has actually helped them with their Olympics coverage, because there are so many ways now for people to watch, and you don't have to commit to doing a block of X number of hours a night of live or semi-live broadcasts.
They're doing it so brilliantly. Like, so for instance, you got Mike Tirico and Peyton Manning are going to be on the NBC feed at the opening ceremony. But then if you want something different, you can pop over to Peacock if you're a subscriber and see Snoop Dogg and the others who are in a studio in LA or whatever. And so what's interesting to me, and it's fascinating, and I think they're doing it brilliantly, but we'll find out in 2 weeks. Is how they're being very, very careful to not step on their subscribers. Because I don't know if you know, Peacock is going to have several very, very important things like Simone Biles and others that NBC is not going to take for tape delay. Is going to do live. And how that works out, you better believe they are watching that closely, will be fascinating for the future.
Well, and of course, the NFL dipped their toes in the water with that last year with a playoff game on Peacock. And of course, for the last several years, the Thursday night Amazon games.
Yeah, didn't they just sign an exclusive second playoff game with Amazon?
Yes.
I don't know. But here's the interesting thing about that. I know when the first playoff game happened, which was 2 years ago, I don't know what happened last year, but 2 years ago was the first exclusive playoff game, I think. I think they actually lost money. I think the company that paid for it, I can't remember who, I think it was Amazon. I think this is the third year of an Amazon game, playoff game. I'm not sure. I'd have to look this up. But they overpaid to get their streaming, to make it work. So we'll see.
But I think that Peacock game last year was one of the most streamed events in the history of streaming.
Yes. And last year it did pay off. So we'll see. I mean, yeah, there's no question the Super Bowl is going to pay-per-view. I don't know how long I'll live and how long it'll take, but it will be there. Well, there'll be two versions of the Super Bowl, frankly, will be at the same time. So, you know, you'll be able to pay for the director's cut. You'll be able to see all 30 cameras, and you'll get Snoop Dogg if you want him, and you'll be able to move all the channels, and then there'll be the regular broadcast, and they'll shift us slowly. They'll do it parallel. But, yeah, eventually the Super Bowl will be pay-per-view.
Well, let's bring it back around to what we started with and continue to talk about the networks, though. What's the future of network newscasts, evening newscasts? Because they don't obviously have the influence they once had. And yet, as you've pointed out, they consistently outdraw the cable networks by substantial numbers.
See, I'm not convinced that they don't have the influence they do. I don't know if we know that answer. So one thing that's just boggled my mind, I think I've even said this when I've appeared previously, is that David Muir has the largest news audience in the United States of America, between 9 and 10 million daily news viewers. Okay, that's more than three times the primetime audience of Fox News. Okay, and nobody is going out there and doing content analysis of ABC News to see how it is shifting, what it is doing and how it's shifting of that week nightly newscast. And same with Lester Holt. Although, interestingly, I just saw a fascinating thing where people complain that Lester Holt was was unfair to Biden in the interview because Holt is a registered Republican. I did not know this. I mean, this is I'm fascinated because there clearly is some kind of influence there, but I don't know what it is.
That's interesting because I didn't know that he was unfair. I think President Biden, I'm pretty sure, knew or should have known what that interview was going to be about.
Well, no, I think people were talking about that one specific clip where he said, what happens if you make another mistake? Do you remember that one?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And Biden laughed and did something. And then instead of kind of going with Biden's laugh, which you see all the time in presidential interviews, like when Bill O'Reilly interviewed Trump and stuff, you know, instead of Holt came right back, didn't kind of, I don't know if you want to call it take the bait or this and that. I think people said in that sense he was being unfair. He's being tougher than Stephanopoulos and others.
What about the theory, and I'm no conspiracy theorist by any stretch, but there are certainly some people out there who believe that the owners of these large media companies may have a preference and aren't crazy about the idea of some of these Biden and perhaps Harris tax proposals that would impact the super wealthy.
Well, you know, Comcast and the Dolans, you know, I'm thinking of them because of NBC and the Olympics and everything. And here's the interesting thing on that sense. Like, I believe that there's a layer of professionalism that still exists between the corporate ownerships and the people who are actually creating the CBS Evening News, the ABC World News Tonight, and NBC Nightly News. So I'm not sure I buy that, but I think where it's much more dangerous is Sinclair Broadcasting is the largest owner of local TV stations, and we know that local television right now is the number one source of political information for Americans.
And we see that, what was it, WGME in Portland, right, is a Sinclair station, I believe?
But it's very interesting because there's this thing called Sinclair's Rapid Response Team with the required inserted fact-checking, and they ran a thing, and it's very biased. It's very biased, and they're not allowed not to run it. But I'm not sure, the professionalism at the local level. We don't have Sinclair up here in Bangor. I'm not sure. You know, I actually do know two people who work for Sinclair stations, and I trust them. They are professionals, but I do wonder, and I've never spoken to it about them, but I do wonder about the ethics of what they're doing.
It's an interesting time in the world of media, as it is the world in general. Michael, great to see you. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks, Rich.
Michael Sokolow, University of Maine, with us here on Downtown. It is 5:26. Coming up, Dennis.